Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to State of the Arts with Michael Sterling and Andrew David James, only on LA Talk Radio.
And it is what day? It
We're
is November the 2nd.
That's right. And it's a beautiful day, despite a little bit of rain in
it
the
is,
area.
It is, you think? Yeah, it's, yeah. It, I mean, from our vantage point, it is, but other it's people might be concerned.
Pretty
I think it's a sad down. Day because the Dodgers lost.
Boy, I tell you, there was some heartbreak on the I saw a lot of sad Dodger flags today on the freeway. Man,
yeah.
That was hard to watch.
Yeah.
Hard to watch.
Poor guys. But, you know, here's the way to rationalize that. I think that because Houston was the victim of so many horrific things
That's
weather-wise
true.
In this country, that they deserved it for that reason alone.
And there's no doubt that that was a great ball team the Dodgers
yeah,
played, man.
I mean,
Houston,
they did.
Got some great young hitters and a lot of really classy ball players there who make great plays, and I saw a lot of good spirits and high fives and that sort of thing. So good for the city of Houston. You'd love to hear that.
Very much
they
so.
They deserve
yeah,
it, absolutely. Still, Dodgers next year. Here we go. Spring training. I'm ready to rock, man.
Wait, so that'll make it. How many years since they were in the World Series?
30 was the last, right? 88 was the last one. So
all right.
29, yeah.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah.
Well, those boys got to buck up next year.
That's right. Time to get back to work.
It was scary. Hoyt and I were talking on the night before when it was
That's
in
right.
the seventh game.
Ooh.
So.
Yeah.
And I'm not a follower necessarily of baseball, but this I pay attention to because it's,
Everyone
I used to represent
did.
Todd Zeal, for God's sake.
Of course, you've got to.
So.
Yeah. It was interesting to watch because, the town really did rather rally around the Dodgers. There's so much to do in this town that I think a lot of time our sports teams kind of fall to the wayside a little bit. You can go to the beach, you can go to see an opera, you can whatever, but it's amazing when you see everybody go, even people who haven't watched a single baseball game, they all got Game 7 on. So that was cool to see at least and hear it coming out of all the houses and all the cars and stuff.
Yeah, very, very Americana.
That's right. Well, obviously, again, here it is, a beautiful day. If you like a little bit of cloudy weather, I'll take this over the heat anytime, no doubt about it.
So. Well, me too. I mean, I think we're at 60-ish degrees and a 20% chance of rain,
I'll
which I hope
that,
it does come down because we had a lot of it this year, but we still need it.
That's right.
So I'm
and we
all
obviously
for that.
Have a great show for everyone today, so should we get
we
right
do.
To it, Michael?
I think so. Yes.
Who do we have here with us?
A couple of amazing performers with us today. Let's welcome two State of the Arts, Mark Singer and Hoyt Richards.
That's right. Good looking.
Wow. I love that.
On our show, we have obviously had a ton of great musical theater performers, but today we have state-of-the-art, legitimate movie stars on the show today.
Slash That's studs.
Cool. No doubt about
yes.
it. Good looking men with beards. My goodness.
You seem to have gotten a standing ovation.
Well, the crowd loves you guys.
They went wild.
I don't know if you saw them in the parking lot. We had to hold them back from mobbing your car. It was unbelievable.
I thought I owed them money. I had to run for it.
The collectors, the bill collectors. Yeah. Guys, we're glad to have you here today, and obviously a couple great projects and great lives we want to discuss today. But even more than that, we've got some really cool things going on around the Southland. What a great time to be in the arts here in Los Angeles, That's a cool thing.
Yeah. It's wonderful.
You guys hang out with us for a few minutes while we pay some bills and come back to you?
Absolutely.
Much appreciated. We'll obviously talk more with them in just a few moments. But before we do that, Michael, let's thank our sponsors.
Yeah. We'd like to thank our sponsor, ladies and gentlemen, Breakdown Services, the entertainment industry standard used around the world, providing the most professional means to reach talent agents as well as actors when casting a project. To learn more about Breakdown Services, visit BreakdownExpress.com.
That's right. We'd also like to acknowledge PerformingArtsLive.com, one of the Internet's most prominent listing sources for the live arts here in Southern California. We're grateful to Performing Arts Live for lending their support to State of the Art.
There we go again. We encourage you folks to visit Breakdown Services and Performing Arts Live to find out more about all of the happenings in the Southland, and including what we're talking about today.
Did you notice how much they loved our sponsors, but they love our guests even more?
I think so. That makes sense.
Our audience is finely tuned today, boys. Finely tuned. Obviously, two great resources, to be sure. And speaking of great things, Michael, I'm dying to hear about your week. I didn't get to go see anything with you this week.
You did not, but I was taking care of business at my own venue, Sterling's, upstairs at the Federal. Do you know the Federal? In North Hollywood?
A great bar and grill down in North Hollywood.
It's believe me, I'll start to go there more regularly if you guys are paying.
Yeah, we'll be there, man.
You will go there.
Vanilla Manhattan's all the way around.
It is a, you know where the El Portal Theater is?
Oh,
and
yeah.
The Television Academy.
Oh, for sure.
It's right in that area.
Yeah.
It used to be called the Federal Bank in 1926, first building in the entire East San Fernando Valley.
That's great.
Other than Universal Studios on the opposite side. So upstairs is a venue that I produce entertainment in, which is the best of Broadway performers in concert and the best of nightclub singers who are dedicated to the Great American Songbook.
Boy, a blend of interesting architecture and interesting cultural history both.
Exactly, yeah, exactly. And a little bit of feeling of being in New York. I always think that when I'm working over there on Sundays.
No doubt about it.
So here's what I did. We had Robert Yacko, who was a guest mm-hmm. last week with Mark Blanchard. And Robert's show, Opening Doors, opened, and I totally forgot the World Series was
starting. Oh, my.
So when I booked it, I didn't know, and nobody knew that the Dodgers wouldn't be in. But so we played to a respectable house, but it was about 60%, but 60% of a very appreciative audience.
That's unusual.
And he did
an
amazing show, and he's such an extraordinary singer. It was interesting to find out about his life, which he weaves in between the song selections and so forth. And many of the pieces that he chose were familiar and some were not familiar, but it was a great evening nonetheless, Dodgers or not. But he had a good time, and the audience had a good time, and that's all that matters, is that they actually, and we put it on the screens and the venue until we had to start the show. So
sure.
We gave them what they wanted in both places.
Well, the Federal's so good about that anyways. But, I mean, Robert's such a compelling performer, and what an interesting man to talk to, too.
He is.
Last week's show was a lot of fun, and I know we've got another one great this week, too. Should we go ahead and dig
I
right
think
in
we
here?
Should.
Let's get started with this fine gentleman sitting to our right.
Our first guest, ladies and gentlemen, found fame in the early 80s with the movie The Beastmaster and its sequels, in which he played the title role. And as Mike Donovan in the 1983 miniseries V, the 1984 sequel V, The Final Battle, and the TV series V, The Series.
He voiced the character of Man-Bat on Batman and the animated series. Guest starring television series roles include Barnaby Jones, Hawaii Five-0, Hotel Dallas, The Twilight Zone, The Hitchhiker, Murder, She Wrote, The Love Boat, The Young and the Restless, The Ray Bradbury Theater, and the Highlander series.
Some of his many film roles include appearances in If You Could See What I Hear, Body Chemistry, Something for Joey, Watchers 2, High Desert Kill, and A Man Called Sarge.
He joins us today to speak about his remarkable career and about his current project, directing A Midsummer Night's Dream, performing the role of Oberon as well. The production opens November 17th with Group Rep Theater in NoHo.
That's right, at the Lonnie Chapman Theater in particular in the NoHo Arts District there. And we are so happy that he could take some time out of his busy schedule to sit down and talk about his love of Shakespeare, Midsummer, and some of his career highlights.
That's
We're so excited to welcome, as we said earlier, give it up again for Mark Singer.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow.
That was such a...
Somebody just took off their top. This is getting ridiculous, Mark. My goodness.
Well, I know that. It was such an effusive build-up. I was looking around to see if somebody else was in the room.
No, I knew it was you because I loved The Beastmaster when I was young, and I often think that any father of two children as crazy as mine should have a title card that says Beastmaster that he can hand out to people all the time.
So. I think you're right. There's nothing wilder than kids.
Of course, the poster for that movie and that series was very, very, unforgettable.
Absolutely. It's an amazing thing about being an actor in Hollywood. You know, one day you're walking down the street and you're thinking your own thoughts and pursuing what you imagine actors pursue, which is, you know, all self-involvement. And the next thing, you're the Beastmaster. You're standing around with tigers. You know, that's the next thing. You know?
Well, obviously, and a great voice. You've obviously done so much wonderful work on television, and people can identify you so quickly. I enjoyed looking up some of your stuff that I'd forgotten about over the years, which I mean, you've been working forever in this town. You must have started when you're 5 years old, yeah?
I did start when I was young. I started actually. I started working on Shakespeare when I was about in the fifth grade.
Wow.
I got turned on to it early and in a good way, and but I didn't discover acting until I was about a junior in high school, and I started on stage. And so when you say that I came into town, I actually came to town in the 70s, which wow. dates me earlier even than that. Yeah, you know.
Who was it that inspired you enough to take up your interest in Shakespeare?
Michael's hoping you say Michael Sterling.
Yes, it was in anticipation because I my father actually was my inspiration as wow. far as that was concerned. I was living in Texas at the time, and I think he thought that it would be some way to focus me and make me a better student, which sadly enough I never became, but I did become. There's always room for us in acting, and so that's what I ended up doing.
Well, now you're working on one of my favorite projects, a show which is one of the few Shakespeare shows I've never done, A Midsummer Night's Dream. How did you get into this project, and where did the concept come from, and what makes you a little different from some of the other productions we may have seen of that show?
Well, it's Midsummer Night's Dream, a lot of people are very familiar with it. It's one of the most popular of Shakespeare's comedies and done a great deal. And it's a funny, sparkling, beautiful show. It takes place in the middle of summer, and it's about lovers who get crossed up. This one falls in love with that one's girl, and that one falls in love with the other one's girl, and they chase each other through the woods, and there's all this kind of stuff going on. And I've just got a great cast down at the Group Rep Theater at the Lonnie Chapman Playhouse. It's just wonderful. What really sort of sparked me about this is that I've seen this play a bunch of times. It's very funny, always amusing. It's like the coldest ginger ale. It's the best and most sparkling.
But nice analogy.
That would be Werner's ginger ale.
I guess so. Pick your preference, but there's always been something missing, and that is that the play doesn't have a lead. You look at Shakespeare's plays. If you're doing King Lear, well, King Lear's the lead. If you're doing Hamlet, Hamlet's the lead. But Midsummer Night's Dream, for some reason, never had a lead. And I was studying the play because I love the play and I've seen it so often. And I realized, no, there is a lead. We've simply missed it. And it misses a lot in Shakespeare. Mm. And it's kind of, there's a real serious side to the production of this comedy, and that is to restore the lead to Midsummer Night's Dream and sort of be a hallmark production so that people who come to see this, if they're from other theaters or other productions, they can look at this and say, you know what, that's the way this play should run from now on. Mm. Sure, we'll do a different interpretation. We'll get a different actor. He'll do this way. We'll get different actresses. They'll do it that way.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, it's now, its architecture is reestablished. And I've been finding with a lot of Shakespeare. I don't want to go too long about this, but I mean, it sort of put me on a mission about Shakespeare because I'm the kind of guy. I once got in a conversation with somebody about playing Macbeth, and they said, "We're going to be doing it next season. Would you be interested?" And I said, "Oh, well, let's see what happens between now and then. We'll get in the conversation." But I immediately went home and memorized all of Macbeth's lines because how are you going to talk about something that you don't understand?
That's right.
So I dedicated myself to Shakespeare, and I began to understand that in the main, Shakespeare is handed down to us in a kind of a traditional fashion that's kind of unexamined. It's like dogma. Yeah. Oh, Macbeth is like this. Lady Macbeth is like that. Midsummer Night's like Dresden. This is like that. Well, why go to the theater?
Yeah.
You have to examine it freshly each time, and when you do, you find out what Shakespeare's really about. And that's kind of the long story of what Midsummer Night's Dream is about. Boy, I'm even tired of listening to
that. Not at all. In fact, I love hearing that because so many times you find directors who try to take the external factors to make it different as opposed to reexamining the characters. So they'll set it in a different time frame or they'll use different costumes. But when you really look at these characters and how they're interpreted, they can be done a number of different ways. And if you really find the heart of Midsummer, I think there's a lot of really meaningful dialogue in there, as in addition to the fanciful fun and comedy that we see a lot as well. So I'm interested to see this production. Can you tell me a little bit about your run coming up as well?
Oh, sure. I'd be happy to. We're going to be opening on November the 17th, and we're going to run all the way through Christmas of this coming year. And we're sort of calling it Midsummer Night's Dream in the middle of the winter season. We're bringing back a little touch of summer to bring some warmth to the colder season here. We think people will really enjoy that.
And just to make sure I'm correct here, it's at the Lonnie Chapman Theater. Is that correct?
That's it.
And it's Group Rep. You can obviously go to www.thegrouprep.com for more information. And if I'm correct, tickets are as low as $15 in certain groups, right? Groups of 10 or more are $15?
It's
unbelievable.
It's eminently affordable. And not only that, but the Lonnie Chapman Theater is a beautiful little playhouse.
Yes, it is.
It's absolutely beautifully appointed. It, that's the reason I got excited about working with the group rep, was that I first saw their stage and I said, I can't believe this. I've got to get up here. This is terrific. I love
it. It's clean. It's kept up. Yeah. It's, you know, they're very friendly, inviting atmosphere, and they've got rehearsal rooms upstairs.
And the actors
mirror
are,
the stage.
The actors are killers. The actors and actresses are just monsters.
And
they're
they
fantastic.
Do very, very good work there. You know, with regard to what you just were talking about with Shakespeare and doing a different production, hoping this should be the hallmark of this particular show. I always think of younger people and how to get them engaged in Shakespeare, especially in this world that we live in at these times. Andrew, who is a fine actor, my co-host, he did a very interesting production of Shakespeare and the Beatles.
Oh, I have. We were talking beforehand. He is a passionate Shakespearean. Oh no, I love it.
Interesting evening because it paired with scenes from various Shakespeare plays, the music of the Beatles, and performances of that music.
Of course, directed by Alan Hunt, who's a great great director, and Kelly Christopherson was in that show
as
well as my counterpart.
Daughter,
lots of it was interesting too because you realize that the interpretation of Shakespeare is so personal
to
so many people. And I mean, your Oberon may be completely different from someone else's.
I guarantee it is.
Yeah, that's the exciting part of it. Well, I can't wait to see this. You were talking a little bit about the concept for the show. What's it like to play the lead Oberon in this production and also direct it? Is that hard to step out of that? And have you ever done that before?
Oh, it's easy peasy. Ooh, yesterday was a 20-hour day. Anybody can do
Didn't
it.
Didn't even break a sweat.
Oh, no. I got home and I was ready to go to bed.
Well,
I was ready to get under the bed. No, it's a challenge to act and direct at the same time. But, you know, my inspiration in getting into theater in the first place, and I know this also sounds a little high-minded, but because of my father, my inspiration in getting to acting was Laurence Olivier. Wow. And Laurence Olivier was well-known, as were many British actors in those days, for not only acting but producing and directing their own productions. And here was an opportunity that Larry Eisenberg and Chris Winfield, the co-artistic directors of the Group Repertory Theater, offered me, and I certainly snapped it up right away. Absolutely.
Good for you.
Yeah.
And good for the theater.
And they couldn't have picked a better voice for Oberon, He sounds like he could rule the forest anywhere, man.
Exactly.
You'll see. It's quite. In fact, this is my 20-hour a day no sleep voice. And I like this. Boy, if I could just keep this all the time.
We'll keep you up all the time.
All actors. Somebody told me once acting is all about hair and voice. And so I'm beginning to believe them.
That's what I majored in college, is hair and voice.
Right. But the issue is that most of the time Oberon is done in a voice sort of like this.
Interesting.
Not ours.
Oh.
We are much different. It's a different Oberon because it tells the real story of why in the Midsummer Night's Dream the Fairy King and the Fairy Queen are at odds with one another. And that's a very touching story.
Cool.
So in our play, we're going to make the audience laugh and laugh and laugh and laugh and laugh, and then we're going to break their hearts right at the end.
Cool. Very cool.
Nice.
Yeah, that's an interesting recipe for theater.
No doubt about it.
There was a movie made of this, wasn't there?
There have been a couple
Oh, there have been movies of this since
Tucci,
time immemorial. There was a Mickey Rooney.
Gross.
There we go. Oh, we could sing that together.
Yeah.
We're in sync.
It's funny. I mean, obviously, this is one of his most produced shows, if for no other reason than it's so accessible to families.
It is.
Right? I mean, this is one of those shows where kids love it, adults love it. It's fun. It's silly. There's a lot of choreography in it, fight choreography, that sort of thing, The Lovers in the Forest. But also, this heart, I mean, it's structurally such a sound show, the fantasy world.
People get distracted in Shakespeare by the great big monster classics like Macbeth and King Lear and Othello and things like that. And something that's so difficult to bring off, as Laurel and Hardy said, which is comedy.
That's right.
Here's this beautiful gem, and it is in every way a striking example of the greatest playwright that ever walked the face of the earth.
That's
just terrific.
Absolutely right. Yeah. No doubt about it.
Yeah. Boy, you are passionate about Shakespeare.
Yes,
you're out there.
He's the reason I started writing when I was young. I got my degree in composition and literature from my undergrad, and it's interesting to me because I read Shakespeare's work, and it's as relevant today as it was then.
Absolutely.
And it always saddens me when someone's turned off by the language because he used it as a tool, right? It was a tool to speak as beautifully
as he could.
And he created so many words that we use in slang now, too, I love. So
Some are.
Green-eyed monster is one. He talks about that in Othello, which nobody's ever used. And so many words that, I mean, like, that we take for granted. In fact, there's a poster somebody did of 1,000 words created by Shakespeare. He was in a lot of English classrooms. And, I mean, you realize they're synonymous with our language now.
Well, the Old West, you know, the many of the cliched lines that we're used to in our old Westerns, like, I don't get your drift, partner. Well, Shakespeare is the guy that used that. He says in one of his plays in Troilus and Cressida, he says, I get the author's drift.
Yeah.
And in Hamlet, I've always wondered why it is that there's this clunky construction where he says, there's the respect that makes calamity of so long life.
That's right.
And why isn't it this one? There's the calamity that there's the respect that makes calamity of so long life.
That's right. Wow.
You see what I mean? It's absolutely modern.
That's absolutely true.
Right.
It's interesting too when you look at all the great plays that Shakespeare wrote, including my favorite Much Ado.
Right.
You realize how good he did at putting comedy and tragedy back to back.
Right.
You know, there's
right.
not one play that doesn't have true heart and true depth.
Right.
And that's why I love your focusing this production on the heart and the depth, because it is so funny, but there's a lot more to it.
Midsummer Night's Dream.
Well, let's talk about it a little bit more on this theater here. We're talking about the Lonnie Chapman Theater at the Group Rep. Again, it's playing November 17th through December 31st, and you have performances on, I believe, Christmas Eve. Is that correct?
That's exactly right.
Amazing.
22, 23, and 24 we'll be playing.
A great chance to take the kids out and the family out and see some theater. Fridays and Saturdays at 8 p.m., Sunday matinees at 2 p.m. Special after Thanksgiving Friday matinee, November 24th at 2 p.m., and Talkback Sundays, November 19th and December 3rd.
And the tickets are very affordable at $25, and students, seniors with ID can pick them up for $20, and groups, $10 plus, $15.
With the family in town for the holidays, you grab a group of 10 or 15 people real easily.
Absolutely, and you simply go to the grouprep.com. address on the internet to buy your tickets, or you can call their reservation line, which is 818-763-5990.
You can get up a class outing.
That's right. Absolutely. A good time for that with schools.
Lonnie Chapman Theater on Burbank Boulevard in North Hollywood.
And just real quick, the Group Rep always does a great job, particularly with classical material, so don't miss that.
Absolutely.
Can you tell me a little bit about the Beastmaster and your experience on that show? I got to know.
There's
so much to talk about in the Beastmaster.
Well, first of all, it must have just totally changed your life instantly.
Absolutely revolutionized it. There's no question about it. You know, you go into a film and you come into the acting profession, everybody does, and they imagine that the acting profession is a little bit like playing a game. You put on a role, you take off a role, you go do another role, you put it on, you take it off. But it really isn't so. Acting is something that builds your character, and all these different personalities that you portray, you have to live up to. And so playing a heroic character who swings a sword and stands out in the middle of the coldest winter in Los Angeles on record at that time in order to make the film for 3.5 months, you're going to find... You're going to find some qualities of Beastmaster in you that you didn't know you had, and you're going to have to rise to the occasion. And when you fight different stuntmen who are the masters of their profession, but you have to also understand that they are super athletes, every one of these guys, and girls, gals, I think that's how you do stunt people, right? Guys and gals. Every one of these guys and gals is a powerhouse athlete in themselves, as well as extraordinarily accomplished filmmakers that you're going to be swinging a sword, even if it's choreographed, against people who are used to taking lumps and bumps and receiving them on a level that you're not used to at all. You'd better get up pretty quick to that level. So being the Beastmaster was really quite a challenge, and at the same time, it was just the greatest growing experience that I could imagine.
Did you feel at the time that you were making the first film that there was some longevity to this?
Oh, no question about it. There was no question that we were standing in a blessed bubble of some sort, and the whole effort resonated with that. I mean, everybody, we were like a family made of professional athletes and skilled artisans and artists all at once, and we were all focused at exactly the right time. We all came together at the right moment in our lives, and we all expressed something that was sincere. So it was really
well
perfect.
Said, and obviously what
that's
a beautiful
it's,
thing.
It's a historic piece of cinema.
And
right?
That's why we all work in this industry, is because you do every now and then, despite the drudgery, you do occasionally get those moments where you feel like you've created something.
You
really
reach
special.
For the truth and you find it sometimes. It's really great. That's the inspiration that drives you forward.
No doubt about
thrilling.
It. No doubt about it. Shall we do a live arts calendar
and
come back with these two gentlemen?
Yes.
All right.
Indeed. We'll do this very quickly. quickly, guys.
Take a quick minute here to talk about another great show coming to the Southland. A funny thing happened on the way to the Forum.
The gods of comedy are pleased. Broadway's big, fat Roman musical is back with a new spin on Pulitzer Prize winner Stephen Sondheim's raucous comedy that pays tribute to the original funny man himself,
Plautus.
I was
That's
say
right.
Pluto.
I thought you were going to say Platypus.
Also funny as well. Ancient Rome is turned on its ear in this bawdy romp of mistaken identity and twisting plots where secrets hide behind every toga. A funny thing happened on the way to the Forum. Runs at the Gary Marshall Theater, the newly named Gary Marshall Theater in Burbank, from November 15th through December 31st.
And for tickets or more information about this show, call 818-955-8101 or visit GaryMarshallTheater.org. And Gary is spelled with two R's, but it should come up easily if you just put it in, probably with one R. But
that's right. That's right.
It's a beautiful theater out on the border of Burbank and Toluca Lake on Riverside Drive, and this is its first season as the Gary Marshall Theater Gary's passing. But it was the Falcon Theater before, and they've always done some great work over there.
Well, and of course, we know so many people over there, and Gary was such a force behind that theater.
He was.
Man. I've always loved that area because there's so many great eateries around there. You go down there, you stop, you get some food, you walk over to the theater. Such a good, comfortable theater. They do a great job there. So,
there was some controversy at one of the restaurants in that area recently.
What happened?
Patty's restaurant.
Oh, I walk by Patty's all the time. I haven't been in for years, but...
I mean, it was in the news. I'm not saying something out of school.
No, but breaking news here on State
some
of the Arts.
An employee put a camera in one of the in the women's bathroom.
Oh my goodness!
And it was discovered suddenly.
Oh my goodness!
And it
goodness.
Had been there apparently for quite some time.
Oh, wow! Really?
And it caused a couple of longtime employees to quit.
Wow!
This goes back to the issue of culture, right?
Exactly.
It's that we have to rescue our culture and turn it around and remind people that there's a value in life beyond just the pop culture kind of twist that happens unregulated.
There's no doubt about it. And obviously, I mean, what a terrible invasion of privacy, but also
absolutely
how awful to discover that. And good for those. I mean, you say people walked out because
two female employees walked out.
Quit.
On the other hand, speaking of Gary Marshall, there's a man that did so much culturally for his community. Across the Southland, find out how many buildings bear his name, how many theaters, how many gymnasiums,
absolutely.
Gary Marshall was an extraordinary philanthropist on behalf of this community.
And created some of the best shows projects.
And totally down to earth.
Very much so.
And one of my favorite actors on film, just a lovely actor.
Right. I always remember him wearing that blue jacket sitting in the back of the Falcon there, what used to be the Falcon, now the Gary Marshall Theater. And I mean, just he was Oberon of that theater. You know, he kind of oversaw everything that went on and did such a good job. We have another, and I hate to say it, but a devastatingly good-looking gentleman sitting here. Man, I'm telling you, if you could get some ugly dudes on this show, I'd look a lot better, Michael.
Gosh,
man. I think we should bring him on in. Let's do it.
Yes, indeed. Originally from the mainline area outside Philadelphia, our next guest boasts a successful career as an actor, screenwriter, author, model, and producer. He graduated from Princeton with a BA in economics, where he also played football. In his early career, he worked as a fashion model for Ford and Wilhelmina Models and is considered by many people to be the world's first male supermodel.
After relocating to Los Angeles, he began working as an actor and now has over 30 films to his credit, expanding his skill set to include directing, screenwriting, editing, and producing. He created his own production company, Tortoise Entertainment, in 2012. With Tortoise, he has produced two independent feature films, which have won nearly 200 awards combined during their respective film festival runs.
The first of these films, Dumbbells, is a buddy comedy set in a rundown gym and parodied some actual events from his own life. Tortoise's second film, Intersection, is a psychological romantic thriller that will be theatrically released in 2018. Intersection became one of the most acclaimed indie films of 2016, winning well over 100 awards, including 50-plus wins for Best Picture and garnering our guest 28 Best Actor awards for his portrayal of Cobb Mills.
Currently, he's directing, writing, and producing a documentary called Blind Spot in the Mirror, The Hoyt Richards Story, that chronicles his 20-year journey into the eternal values religious cult and his subsequent escape and recovery.
He is also co-authoring a book, Seemed Like a Great Idea at the Time is the title, with best-selling author Kim Wong Keltner, also an ex-Eternal Values member, cataloging their journey and their friendship through the cult years and after.
He speaks publicly about the dangers and lessons learned from his experience with the cultic and abusive environments, and also assists families and individuals who have loved ones caught in the cult situations.
We're so happy to have him back on the show today to talk about his extraordinary life and current work. Please give him a warm welcome. He's an amazing talent, Mr. Hoyt Richards. He's back.
Well, it's good to be back.
I always have a fondness for this man because he was one of my first shows 2 years ago when we sat down and I saw this intimidating producer, director, and realized he actually was a nice human being, which just restored my faith in the industry, man. Well, I got to tell you.
I think the industry needs a little restoration right about now. Well, now but I tell you, I think all the witch hunting that's going out is great. I mean, I tell you, if we can bring to the front all these people that have misbehaved like
that's
they have,
right.
I'd say, I mean, all for it.
You know, it's interesting too, because that's such an important issue right now, and I think it's, you know, I was raised not to be judgmental, right? You don't ever judge somebody, but there is a purpose to say, hey, look, this has been a culture that's been allowed, and if you don't punish this, if you don't bring this to the forefront, then there's a major problem. Now, one of the things that you experienced, and whenever you come on the show, I'm always worried, because we spend so much time talking about this man's amazing life that we forget to promote the amazing films he's doing. You know, like Intersection, which is so good, and Dumbbells, which was so funny as well. But now you finally combined your amazing life with one of these projects. What is it like to do your own life story? Is that hard?
Yeah, it's been really interesting, and it's been an evolution. Obviously, it whenever you go through something like I went through and continue to go through, there's kind of an obligation on some level that you survive something with the feeling of, you need to share it, because why did you go through this and overcome things that you never... You know, first of all, I found myself in a situation I never dreamed about, and I got through it in a way that I never imagined either. But I also affected everyone who cared about me in my life. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of healing that needs to happen. And through that process, lessons get learned, and there's a desire to share that story, because I think we all have those days where we think, oh, I'm having a bad day, and, you know, woe is me. And then you hear someone else's story, and you go, you know what? It's not too bad. You know,
so is that your thing? You're the guy who makes everybody else's life seem good?
Yeah.
At least I wasn't in a cult. I don't think that's good, Hoyt.
I don't know. I mean, all I know is that survivor tales do tend to inspire us and remember, hey, listen, you know, I can keep my chin up and I can get through this somehow. And I love those type of stories. So if I can be one of those ones that possibly lets someone go, oh, wow, I've never thought about things that way, and this story, and it could happen to someone like you or me. I mean, that's really the main motivation. And I just don't want people following, you know, into the same steps that I did of thinking this can't happen to you. And the main message that I try to, you know, work within the cult survivor community is that there's certain myths out there that exist from the point of view of, well, oh, there's a kind of person it happens to, or mm-hmm. a kind of profile that they have, or, you know, and they're, you know, and groups target a certain kind of person, and it's just not accurate. So ultimately, the only way you can have any level of protection is to have some sort of knowledge about it, because if you're like me and have no idea, then you won't see what's happening. You know, the most common analogy of how you get involved in any sort of abusive environment, certainly a cult, is the boiling of a frog. You know, like you throw a frog in hot water, it jumps out. You throw it in lukewarm water,
little
by little, you turn up the heat, it'll stay in there till it boils. And that's what's happened, you know, when you get in these situations. And it's no different than the bad, you know, love relationship where you get love bombed by who your partner's just telling you how great you are, and then you're in, and you end up 6 years from then going, how did I get in this toxic relationship? Right. Like, how did I get here? So the cult is like that scenario, but on steroids.
You just described me and Michael. Michael looks at me every week. It's like, how am I sitting across from this guy?
How did this ever happen?
Well, you were young when this happened.
Yeah, absolutely.
Were you at Princeton at the time?
This is before Princeton. And youth is a factor, but it's certainly not a prerequisite in the sense that this can happen to anyone at any point. But I would say there is a perfect storm that has to happen from the point of view of, if you have to be at a point in your life where you're asking questions or seeking something on some level, and if you come across a person or a group that from your point of view is providing answers, then there's receptivity, and that's where it's potentially dangerous, because in any sort of opportunity to kind of share information. Like, say we were all talking, and I said something to you, Michael, and you said, "Oh my God, I never thought of it that way. Wait, that's actually really fascinating, like an epiphany of some sorts." Now, I would feel almost instinctively the inclination to kind of relieve any sense of debt by saying, "Oh, I read this book, you should check it out," or "I took this class, I learned that," or "I went through this experience." I would feel some obligation to say, "This is how I came to this information," and there's no ownership of it from that point of view. And the unhealthy relationship, the person's like, "Well, you know, Michael, I'm here for you, and if anyone more questions, consider me a resource." And you don't, and you're like, "Oh, great, wow, I've got like a mentor, and this is really cool." And you don't realize that's a very subtle form of manipulation.
Sure.
And so that's how it starts. So, you know, it's like any of these groups quite often, like, I mean, you hear about Scientology now and these stories of the philosophy. You keep thinking, God, how did you ever fall for that? But it doesn't, they don't open with that stuff. You start with a very soft pitch. You know, for me, it was just Eastern philosophy and this idea of accountability with the law of karma. You know, I'd been brought up Christian. I really wasn't really devoutly religious. I always believed in God. But, you know, this idea of like, oh, I just go to church every Sunday and, you know, I get, as long as I put some money in the till, then I get a clean slate and come back next week.
Yeah.
I'm like, that's not really the, you know, that's, and then
you were looking for something.
Well, so I just, you know, I mean, I'm 16. I put it this way. I didn't have a game plan, which I don't think many 16-year-olds have. And I think whenever you meet anyone who's really excited about their game plan, and it certainly sounds a hell of a lot better than your no plan, you're receptive. And that's how it starts. And because he was in that context mentioning things that I was always curious about, like Eastern philosophy, like astrology, like ancient civilizations, that's, I mean, literally, he's just on the beach, like, you know, drawing some yin and yang things. And I'm thinking, first of all, he's about 20 years older than me, and he's talking to me like an adult, which I'm right. Thinking that's great. And you don't think you're going to meet a cult leader on Nantucket Island. Like, that's not where you think, like, oh, well, that's where you get into danger. I mean, Nantucket is a place where you can take your 9 and 10-year-olds and let them run free. There's one town. It's got cobblestone streets. There's virtually nothing that can happen. I mean, it's a contained environment. So it's just a place that, from a lack of a better description, you would have your guard down anyway. So you just don't think anything dangerous could possibly happen. And
so true.
It was kind of just the way it
all
started.
From his perspective, he probably chose that location because there's a lot of wealth there.
You know, I don't even want to empower him with that much of a game plan. Like, this is a narcissist who just was seeking attention. Yeah. And I don't think he even had the game plan of becoming a cult. He wanted an entourage, and he very much built his own self-image, from my point of view, on the people that surrounded him. He looked at that as a reflection of who he was. So if you were bright, if you were good-looking, if you had some sort of social stature, he was very into the whole social thing. Like, his phone book was the social register. I didn't even know there was a social register until, I met this guy. And then he was very caught up in all of that. So all those things were, he was just seeking attention from the people that he wanted to get attention from. And then he had this kind of mishmash of philosophies that kind of involved Eastern cultures and then also the Bible. And then, like, there was a Edgar Cayce, from Virginia Beach at all these. And so he kind of did a mishmash, put them all together. And then in 1985, when I was graduating college, this woman who was his metaphysical writer, Ruth Montgomery, had written a number of best-selling books in that community, wrote this book called Aliens Among Us, which had 4 chapters that basically validated this guy Frederick's life.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, it's kind of like he got transported into getting like street cred. And now all of a sudden, we took on a more formal cult-like persona in the sense that we had to create an office, we had to create assets to kind of get
people
information.
You got to go public.
We were doing. He had a TV show and he had a radio show, but then and now we had seminars. Now we had all these sort of, and it became like a big recruitment thing, and the whole thing took. So it's like being in a startup, except the startup was a cult. Like, I was in on the ground floor. By the time I graduated college, I moved in with the group, and it was all just starting then. So, like anything, as the frog cooking, I just didn't see it happening. And I have friends who were concerned, but even them, they were like, no one's comfortable saying, "Oh, I think you're in a cult," because no one really knows.
And it's the 80s, too.
It's the mid-80s. Yeah.
And when did it start to coincide with your modeling career?
Well, the interesting thing
was the other way around.
It actually kind of did, in the sense that I was playing football at Princeton and still holding. Once you're playing Ivy League football, you realize you're probably not going to play.
You weren't the kicker, right?
No. No, I played free safety, and and the tackling was just destroying my shoulders. I'd been a running back and a wide receiver in high school, so the defense was just kind of,
you were breaking down a little bit.
Yeah, because I'd been a gymnast, so I had loose ligaments to begin with, and the tackling just did not do me great.
Violent sport.
Things. So I ended up in this identity crisis where my shoulders were causing problems, and they were basically saying you can't really play anymore, and I didn't want to hear that. And I went up to New York to get a shoulder specialist's point of view, and he basically said, you know, we can operate, we can't guarantee full mobility, and you might be able to be ready by senior year. So that was not what I wanted to hear, and it was very, you know, disappointing. And it was right at that point where he kind of said, oh, you could be a model or an actor. Like, you've always, you know, this is something, because he had done some modeling, he had some point of view. And, at 20 years old, 21, wherever I was, when you're having that type of crisis, I'm like, well, you know, if I can't be a football star, I guess I'll just try to be a star, you know. And it's like, that's literally as much as I thought about it. Like, I knew my life was going to shift. All my roommates and friends were football players. Like, how was it going to put my energy into something? So this was a new thing to try to tackle. And
where's my button? Hold on. I want to jump forward real quick, if we can, a few years here, because this is crucial to me, because the story that you just told, while important and amazing, is not the most important story, right? What you told is a story about how this happened to someone who is a brilliant economics major, who was almost put it in your bio, who was an alpha male football player, who was strong, who's good looking, who came from a good family, and all those things you wouldn't expect them to be subjugated to the cult experience, and yet you were. But that's not what's interesting. What's interesting is your recovery, the fact that you got away from this, that you stood up and when almost no one else could on this planet. I mean, that's so hard to do, and you changed your life and became an artist who's open and able to talk about this. How did that happen, and where does the title Blind Spot in the Mirror come from?
Yeah, well, first of all, thank you very much. And the recovery is the most important part. I mean, it's one of the things I say to people, that you think being in the cult stuff, try being in a bubble like that for 15 years and then re-entering the world when you've...
Right.
It's basically like what they're telling you in the cult is, we're pulling you out of the matrix, and this is what's really going on. And then you find out that's all a lie, and you now have to go back into the matrix knowing that you've told everyone else that they were completely full of it. Yeah, yeah. And anyone who cared about and cares about you, you took on this journey with you involuntarily.
Ugh.
So there's a massive amount of healing that needs to happen. And, you know, because of all the kind of soul searching that goes through, and it's literally like a spiritual rape, in the sense that your most noble attributes is how you're being manipulated.
Mm-hmm.
So this idea of trying to develop a nomenclature and an ability to communicate and relay to someone else what your experience was, so that you can give them the permission to ask you whatever you want, because that's what needs to happen, rather than, you know, there's this compulsion initially to just tell people, listen, I was in a cult. Like, whatever you see when you walk in, that's not who I am. I'm a cult guy, you know? And I can say that because that's what I experienced. Like, literally, I had spent so much of my life living this double life of being Johnny Supermodel in the public eye and having this very private, secretive life that was quite dark and twisted. And yet, at the time, I thought it seemed like a great idea, because we were here to save the world, you know, and we were this separate system that no one's going to possibly understand. And then to try to come back and realize, okay, that's all was BS. I totally, you know, bought into this thing. I was manipulated. I was brainwashed. Yet I was there. I did these things, or I didn't stop things from happening. I said things, or I didn't say things that I could have said. All that thing, you know, comes, you know, to a fruition of saying, okay, now I have to re-enter to the world. And how do I explain to someone what that was like? And if you can't, you know, do that, then you get stuck. And the big thing that people go through is they're afraid and they're shameful. And what I've come to realize, when I would tell this story, I kept thinking, okay, this is a crazy story that I'm going to tell people anyway, right? Because I have to. Like, I can't continue to keep hiding and let people think whatever costume I was given that I inherited from my parents is who I am. Like, this is really who I am.
In that sense, I don't mean to interrupt, but in that sense, I think there's an enormously positive effect that has. It's having it on me sitting here right now. And it is that, therefore, all of that stuff that you went through, and all of that stuff that you say that you took other people along with, which we all do whenever we get led astray, you in a super intensive way, all of that stuff was not wasted. Mm-hmm. It all came forward, and you took it and turned turned it into something that's of value that you bring to people now and that you bring to your life then. Because I was going to ask you, as this was all going forward, is how do you deal with those feelings, the negative feelings that you, that all then puts on you about your own decision making and how you did this and this and all of that, that can load up as guilt. Yeah. And as a dark side turned against yourself. No, you've turned it into something that is valuable and none of it has gone to waste.
Well, thank you. And that really is the recovery process. Right. Like you start to realize you don't use words like wasted years or lost years. Like it's the school of hard knocks that you took courses that I wouldn't recommend anyone else to take.
Right.
But you learn certain life lessons. And if that's what it takes to get to this point where I am now, where I could have developed a sense of compassion and empathy, you know, and also a radar for people, anyone who's in any sort of abusive environment, man, I can like feel it on them. And that's a wonderful place to be because you can show some kindness and sensitivity to someone who you don't even know just because you just want to assure them that it's going to be okay.
Yeah.
You know, and you just come from a different place. And so if it took me this journey to get to this place, so be it. Like, you know, that's the way you do exactly what you're saying, you know, Mark, in the way that you have to take the lemons and you make lemonade.
Yeah.
I love what Einstein said. He goes, the most important decision we're going to make in life is whether you believe the universe is friendly or hostile.
Interesting.
And if you believe in a friendly universe, you have to say, listen, I went through this for my benefit. I have to find the silver lining, and I'm going to, and I'm going to make sure that, you know, people understand that talking about a cult experience is cool. Like you don't have to make it a big deal. Like, and what I found and what you're saying as well, Mark, when I would tell the story, like, you know, like any sort of good storytelling, it only works if I, being the person hearing the story, can play a version of it in my own mind from my life.
Mm-hmm.
So I was initially telling the story like, okay, this is crazy, but I'm going to be transparent.
Right.
And then I would start telling the story and people would start going, wow, that reminds me of this guy or girl. We've all had a cultic relationship, as they say in a clinical term, is any relationship, and it's usually the one-on-one relationship, where the person you're seeking the love and approval from is the person who's abusing you. So welcome to the human condition. Yeah. Shakespeare wrote all about it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's like that situation of where we get in this place of like, no matter what I do, it's never good enough. Now, how do I try it?
Right.
I'm always told it's not, you know, I need to do more. And whenever there's a problem, it's always my fault. Like, we've all had that. So whether it's a parent, whether it's a teacher, a coach, a lover, whatever it is, that is part of the human condition. So I went through that on steroids.
Yeah.
You know, because, you know, the cult, you know, has the peer pressure element, and then the stakes are just so much higher because it's not, well, just one person I have to, you know, satisfy. No, the fate of the world lies in balance. And if we don't get our, you know, act together, then the world's going to go down.
Well, so it's come full circle now. Now you're putting it into a book and you're making a documentary about this, which can only be helpful to people that might feel that they are in some sort of similar situation or prevent them from becoming involved. Right.
Yeah, exactly.
I think
that, you know, knowledge is power. I mean, it still doesn't guarantee success. I mean, that's the most extraordinary thing. They have people who are considered cult infiltrators that literally get schooled in mind control and cults and all that, and then they go into cults to try to determine what's going on and if there's a way to kind of maybe, you know, bring down the organization. And even like more than half of those people get pulled in because even prepared with all that, you have tangible, visceral experiences that we've all been in church when, or in a football stadium, when you have this group psyche thing, you feel it, and that can twist the way we're looking at things.
Well,
you don't realize
the abusive. What I'm also getting from this in an individual way, and when I say individual, I mean every individual kind of way, is that. Abusive cultic state of mind or receptivity, it exists in all of us already. And so that when you were talking about people saying, yes, well, I know somebody who's kind of like that, or I know somebody, well, there's also, I know bits and pieces of my own personality that are like that.
Mm-hmm.
And
so
really you turn a spotlight inward upon yourself and say, where am I cultic in my thinking about certain aspects of life itself? And that itself is a round robin that's not very friendly.
And we're social creatures, so we like to be a part of something.
Right.
You like
that's
to be
true.
A part of something bigger than ourselves. And you know, we're basically hardwired to be followers.
Right.
And from a certain point of view, it takes an incredible personal journey to become a leader, so to speak. And so the shortcut and the easy way to go is to find someone to follow. And that's what these groups are basically selling. You don't recognize it at the time, but they're basically selling a shortcut. And they're basically saying, we see you as the type of person that is deserving of this. So they're kind of stroking your ego. Right. And life is difficult, but we figured it out. So everything's handled. You just have to follow the system. Yeah. And we found you, and we see you, and we see the potential and the special parts about it. And you don't realize at the time, it's like, oh, well, this is, oh, so I don't have to figure out, I don't have to go through the struggles of the human, you know, existence. No. You get a pass on that because you're one of us.
Hoyt, where can people find out more about you and about this project, Blind Spot in the Mirror, the Hoyt Richards story?
Well, you know, you can always check my social media stuff. You know, I'm on Twitter and on Facebook. I'm actually just putting up my website, HoytRichards.com. And
interesting name.
You actually got that website?
Yeah, I actually got that. Yeah. Yeah. And I've got cards. They have little scratch and sniff pads on them.
Nice.
It's going to be coming more and more, but, you know, it's interesting. This has been a really interesting process to go through. They're finally, I mean, I wouldn't say it's like an albatross around my neck, but it's to finally be moving forward with these projects, which I've carried for a long time. It feels great to finally be moving them into fruition.
And one of them, you know, that made you a star is you've had a slight resurgence in your modeling.
Yeah, well, you know, as they say,
is your backside on a bus again in New York City?
Yeah, that hasn't happened yet. I'm still holding out. I'm hoping, but I guess what's old is new again sometimes. Yeah. You know, I'm part of that baby boomer generation, and I guess.
Well, you went over to Europe. You walked the runways.
The beard is in. So I started wearing the beard, and you never know what could happen. And it's been fun. I mean, it's been.
California Magazine just did an article
on you and
four others.
That's it. I'm buying a beard after the show, man.
That's right.
The costume shop and get
fear
one of
the beard,
things.
Baby. It's a game changer. But it's the modeling thing was tied to some really uncomfortable memories for me. So it's actually been really fun to go back, you know, even in the small scale that I'm doing it now, but to go back and actually have some positivity assigned to it, because there was one person at one point said to me, I think you have so much pain tied to your periods of success that you now have, because I was saying, I'm struggling in certain areas.
That's interesting.
And they were like, you probably unconsciously identify success with pain. I'm ready to have success with no pain.
All your life experiences have reaped rewards for you because you're a hell of an actor, and all of the awards that you've received for that have certainly been merited.
No, thank you.
So keep an eye out for Intersection. It's still out there quite a bit, and
it's going to be coming out next year.
Amazing.
So we haven't gotten the release date, but we're close to naming that, so that'll be to be named.
You know, typically at this point of the show, we spend a little humorous time asking about our guests' most embarrassing moments in their performing careers. And if we let you each have a minute, do you think you can come up with something?
No, I'd have to refer you to the encyclopedia of that. I'm not quite certain what would be the most embarrassing.
Well, let's give it a proper intro.
Right.
And now, embarrassing moments.
And once the button's been pushed, there's no getting out of it, man. I'm sorry. Voice
clearly,
of God has spoken
clearly.
Here. So the reason we do this is to tell people a little bit about the worst thing that's happened to successful performers so they remember that no matter how bad something happens to them, they can go on. Hoyt, do you have anything for us here?
Well, I do remember I was doing a fashion show in Barcelona.
That's how they all start.
and there, at this point, fashion shows are crazy to begin with, but some of the things they ask you to put on are ludicrous. And there's not actually things that are in the actual line of clothes. It's just to kind of make a show. So there was this one costume that this other model, and I'm going to throw him under the bus for this, but Marcus Schenkenberg refused to wear. And this guy is like the body model and everything. And so I'm like, I've got my kind of, self-righteous thing, like, screw it, I'll wear it. Like, no problem. Like, I don't even look at what it is, but it is this Speedo, tiny little Speedo with furry boots and a midriff that is, it starts here and then goes all the way to my arms, feathered.
I'm so glad I didn't. That's why I'm going to wear it.
Really?
And I'm like, I'm just going to wear it like an Armani suit. I'm just going to go out there and just let it literally hang out. And of course, and I'm thinking, like, it's no big deal. I get out there, and literally, it's like every photographer decides that's the time to take the picture.
Oh, no.
And I didn't. I never lived that one down. I mean, literally, there was nothing left to the imagination. So.
Mark, you ever had anything embarrassing happen?
I do. I was at that fashion show.
I was taking the pictures.
And I'm the guy that bought that outfit. And so I wore it on Broadway once, and I got a lot of attention. I think that was the moment.
And now we see your new take on Oberon.
Yeah.
Oh, ladies and gentlemen, we've got a couple great guests today, and we could go forever with you guys. We want to remind you again about the names of the project. Blind Spot in the Mirror, the Hoyt Richards story, coming out soon, so keep an eye out for that. And, of course, A Midsummer Night's Dream at the Group Rep.
November 17th through December 31st.
Obviously a great project, and you can obviously go to thegrouprep.com. That's thegrouprep.com. Or you can always email them as well if you just Google their email address. It's very simple. It's info@thegrouprep.com. You can also check out the Gary Marshall Theater that's got some really cool stuff going on, including A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum.
There you go.
Michael, great to see you. And
nice to see you, sir.
I want to say a big thank you to both these guys. Yeah?
Thank you so much for being here.
Our pleasure. All those fans out there, we love that peanut gallery.
That's right. Honestly, great and important stories, and such a wonderful new take on A Midsummer Night's Dream. I certainly hope you and wish you guys the best, and hope you have a great holiday season coming up as well.
Pleasure being here.
When do I see you again, Michael?
Next week on the radio.
You're listening to State of the Arts with Michael Sterling and Andrew David James, only on LA Talk Radio.